This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support comes from Brian Lowe Financial. Your number is 877-217-5757. You can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. We're joined by one of our most erudite guests, John Berry, author, historian, former coach at Tulane University, where he now teaches as a distinguished scholar. His most famous book is Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi
Flood. I'm here, but can't hear anything.
Okay. The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. John Berry is the writer of that. And, Alondra, you're going to have to get John on the phone. I just heard him say he could not hear anything. So let's see what's going on. But John also wrote about the pandemic of the flu in 1918. And this, of course, was something that the world faced. And estimates are that at least 1% and perhaps more of the world population died 100 years ago. It was a three-year event. And John Berry wrote compellingly about this book, which perhaps next to Rising Tide is his most well-known work, the 2004 book, The Great Influence of the Epic Story of the Greatest Plague in History. And John Berry, I hope you can hear me now. John, are you able to hear me? Okay. Alondra, call him back and see if we can get a better line, and maybe that'll solve the riddle here. But the coronavirus is something that is ongoing, and of course it is something in China that has caused the markets to be rocked, businesses to shut down, and people are taking precautions, and we really don't know where it's going. I saw one Harvard scientist indicated that as many as 70% of the world population could be affected by the coronavirus. And that's the worst-case scenario, I would hope. But let's hope it does not get to that point. At this point, we only have a few thousand reported cases, and we have a limited number of deaths. But it is something that we're watching. And, of course, the stock market, the much-hailed Dow Jones Industrial Average, which has gone up under the president we currently have, Donald Trump, by about 50%, would have gone up even more probably if it were not for this epidemic or pandemic that is afflicting the world right now. As we look today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is at 29,295. It's down 102 points, and that is a modest drop. That's hardly significant in these days. The percentage is 0.35%. But you can imagine if this virus takes hold, it will affect the world at large. 877-217-5757 is your number. And John Berry, I believe we have you on the line. So, my friend, good morning
to you.
Finally.
How are you?
Well, what about comparisons between 1918 through 1920 and today? How is it analogous?
Thankfully, it's not. In 1918, I didn't hear all your introduction, but the two-thirds of the deaths occurred in about 14 weeks. So it was really an incredibly intense experience in the fall of 1918. There was another wave in winter 1919, January to April, and then sort of petered out after that. This is first, you know, nothing like that. It's probably more severe than ordinary seasonal influenza, which is nothing to take lightly. 2 years ago, ordinary, regular, seasonal influenza killed 61,000 Americans. So this, if this is more severe than that, which it does look like, it's not something to dismiss out of hand. By the same token, it's not the end of the world. The only solid number that we have is how many people who are hospitalized die. I mean, we really have no idea how many cases there are. So we don't have a case mortality rate. But we do know that probably about 12-15% of the people who are hospitalized with this disease die. and that is quite a bit more serious than ordinary seasonal influenza.
How many did you say, John?
Probably about 12 to 15%. There are a couple of studies out there that have slightly different numbers.
All right.
Again, you don't know how to divide that. You don't know if there are 75,000 cases or if there are, there are a million cases out there. No idea.
Well, the latest report at the start of the week was that there were 73,000 cases, but you're right.
But
that's only reported.
Who presented themselves to for medical care and were tested and tested positive. There's a great shortage of of testing kits. Not everybody is going to the doctor and so forth and so on. I'll give you a comparison. If you recall back in 2009 when we had the H1N1 influenza outbreak, officially there were 18,000 deaths because that's the number who they ran the tests. They confirmed it was that virus. Subsequently, they figured there were at least 300,000 and possibly a good many more deaths. Now, I'm not suggesting that I think the death toll from this disease is probably pretty close to accurate. So I'm not suggesting there are tens of thousands, much less hundreds of thousands, of more people who are dying out there. That's not the case. But in terms of the actual people who have some illness, the case counts are not reliable. The new cases every day, I hope those are accurate, because those are actually going down, which to me is almost incredible. It's a sign of China is the only country in the world that could pull anything like this off, because it has a combination of incredible high technology and at the same time the authoritarian jackboot they can put on your neck to enforce it. Even so, I question whether they're going to end up being successful containing the virus. I think it's pretty unlikely.
Well, in 1918 through 1920, the estimate was a half a billion people, wasn't it, as far as those who were infected? I think over a quarter of the world population was infected.
Right. The population was 1.8 billion. Today it's over 7.5 billion. And the estimate is about 500 million were infected. The death toll, today the best estimates for the dead are between 50 and 100 million, which, if you adjust for population, would be about 225 million to 450 million people today. So you have some pretty scary numbers out there from that influenza pandemic. Again, this doesn't look anything like that at all, but it's serious.
How did it get out of control in 1918?
Well, I mean, it's the nature of the virus. It's not that anybody even tried to control it, really. I mean, you can't. In fact, there's some data, I'm not sure it was ever published, that I found in the National Archives. The Army had very good data. There were 120 military bases in the United States that had a population, I forgot the exact number, but something like 1,000 or more soldiers. A lot of them were 40, 50,000. Training camps, and most of them tried to quarantine soldiers, even to the extent they were taking their temperature and looking for symptoms two times a day, and if a soldier had any symptom, they were immediately isolated. If two soldiers in the unit had symptoms, the entire unit was quarantined and isolated. And they later found, and there were other camps that didn't do any of this, didn't even attempt to quarantine. And there was no difference, zero difference, zero, in terms of the ultimate morbidity, how many people got sick, and mortality, how many people died. There was no difference between the camps that tried, the camps that didn't, in the numbers. The only difference was that in the camps that rigidly enforced quarantine, they did succeed in slowing the spread of the disease. So there was less stress on the healthcare system of that camp and so forth and so on. But in the end, the same numbers of people got sick and died. So if you couldn't successfully quarantine a military camp in the middle of a war, the idea of quarantining and containing the virus in a civilian community during peacetime seemed inconceivable to me. However, the Chinese are certainly making an attempt, and they actually are making real progress.
All right, hold tight. We do have to go to a break, but we're visiting with John Berry, author of The Great Influenza, the epic story of the greatest plague in history, and we'll return after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, or talk at talklouisiana.org. John Berry is our guest, the fabulous writer who's spending a lot of quality time in New Orleans, where he has worked for many years. And, of course, he wrote the definitive book about the 1927 flood, which took out much of South Louisiana, even went farther than that. And, of course, he followed that up with his book about the 1918 influenza pandemic. And now the world is watching to see where the coronavirus is going. And I was mentioning, as we were trying to get you on the line a few moments ago, there is a Harvard researcher who was quoted in the New York Times who says that he believes 40 to 70% of the people in the world could be affected by this. Is that a realistic
Is that Mark Lipsitz?
I think so.
Just curious. Yeah, I know Mark. I'm not, again, I didn't hear your introduction, but after my book came out and bird flu emerged, I became very involved in the pandemic preparedness effort and planning public health measures to try to mitigate a pandemic and so forth. So I've gotten to know a lot of those folks. Some of them are pretty good friends. Mark Lipsitz is a very, very good epidemiologist. So it could do something like that. Everybody gets a cold, and this is a virus like the common cold, but there are so many things we still don't know about it. We really don't know how contagious it is. If you walk past someone on the street and, you know, that person exhales, are you going to get sick? Or is it going to require much more contact than that? We really don't know. And it'll take a while before we do know.
A listener asks whether we should wear masks, particularly on flights. Is that something that's advisable?
No, I don't think masks are very useful unless you are sick. If you are sick and you put a mask on, then it will help contain if you cough or something like that and, you know, spit and so forth, whether, you know, maybe a small particle, but some moisture is going to come out. I mean, it'll block a lot of that, and that will protect people around you. However, a mask is not going to protect you from a really small particle floating around in the air. It's like a chain link fence with trying to stop mosquitoes. It's not going to do a thing about it. You know, the virus is a lot smaller than that surgical mask. So I know in the Asia, you know, everybody seems to be wearing masks, but I don't think they do a lot of good protecting well people.
There's a story, as you can imagine. This is front page news daily, and in the New York Times today, a dateline from Tokyo, a day before 328 Americans were to be whisked away from a contaminated cruise ship in Japan. The U.S. Embassy in Tokyo told passengers that no one infected with the coronavirus would be allowed to board charter flights. But as the evacuees began filing onto two reconfigured cargo planes for departures to military bases Monday, some noticed tented areas separated from the rest of the cabin, and then reality hit after 12 days stuck on the cruise ship, where more and more people were testing positive for the virus. They were now sharing planes with people carrying the same virus they were desperate to escape. So It is now in the United States. Does that mean that it just takes off and goes, or is it too early to tell us on something?
Well, I mean, those people are going to be quarantined. The question is whether, I mean, we know it's already here. There were, I guess, 15 cases prior to these passengers returning. The question is it spreading from those 15 cases? Because if you have a cold, and the overwhelming majority of cases are simply like the common cold, you may not go to the doctor, and yet you may have the virus and spread it. If you have those, if you do go to the doctor, and you they're not testing for the disease, unless you've been to China. So it's I don't want to scare anybody, but you know there is a reasonable possibility that the virus is in the United States besides those few cases and could be spreading. The thing that I'm a lot more concerned about is Africa and places like Indonesia. Now, they both have direct flights from China. Indonesia has direct flights from Wuhan. Indonesia has practically no public health infrastructure, at least compared to what we have or what a place like Singapore, which is excellent, has. And Indonesia doesn't report a single case. I really find that difficult to believe. Frankly, you know, it's possible, but they'd be really, really, really fortunate if that were the case. And the last I heard, they had only tested 50 people. But they would have had a lot more people flying in from Wuhan than 50 before those flights were stopped. So if the virus is circulating in a place like Indonesia, a pretty good-sized country, if it's circulating in Africa, which I believe it reported one case, but in the entire continent, initially there were only two laboratories capable of testing for the virus, although there are now a lot more than that. You know, if it's circulating there, then, yeah, it's going to get all over the world. It's a question of when. And back to what I was saying first, it's not the end of the world. It's not a plague that's going to kill everybody. But it's, at the same time, you know, worse than ordinary influenza. And ordinary influenza, you know, killed 61,000 Americans a couple of years ago.
All right. Now, worst case scenario, of course, is that as the year moves along, this gets more dangerous and it will affect the economy. And John is a student of that as well. And you can only imagine, John also was, as I mentioned in the intro, a fabulous football coach and assistant on the Tulane team that beat LSU 14-0 December 1, 1973. But can you imagine Tiger Stadium if this is in full bloom on a Saturday night? I don't imagine a lot of people want to be in close proximity to others when the guy next to you might have coronavirus.
It depends who they're playing, I think. So, I don't know what's their schedule next year.
Well, Alabama comes here first
Saturday. That's what I thought. I think they're
so they might risk it for that. But
well, and it depends on the severity of the disease. You know, in 1918, they canceled sporting events. They actually canceled the Stanley Cup Finals. They had started playing them and canceled them. They got two or three games played. So there was no Stanley Cup champion in 1919. Everything was closed down. You know, restaurants, theaters, churches. You couldn't go to worship. In China, it's like that now. I'm sure you've seen pictures of Beijing and, you know, major cities. You know, nothing moving on the street, just nothing. It's eerie. So they are doing everything they can to contain it. You know? Again, my feeling is that it's not possible, but they could prove me wrong. I mean, they have this combination of technology. You know, they track people's cell phones. They're sort of registered in a way. They're not in the United States. They can tell who was on a subway car when there was, you know, 3 weeks ago when somebody on that car had coronavirus. Later tested positive, and they can track those people down. This is an incredible combination of technology and will and authoritarian power. Things that would not be possible in a free society in terms of locking people in and quarantining and so forth and so on for an extended period. And they're doing it. If it happened here, there's no way we would be able to pull something like that off.
We're going to spend a bit more time with John Barry. Again, your number is 877-217-5757. And we will return with more thoughts about coronavirus and much more from this astute man after this pause for the news. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Alondra Villarreal is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with John Barry, one of the best writers in the world, and he lives in New Orleans most of the time, and he is there as we wait to see what happens with the coronavirus. And right now, it's not under control, but it's not as widespread as some predicted, but it's still too early to tell. I think we've gotten that from this fine gentleman. And as we look at other issues, a listener, Tracy at the Capitol, says you can't let John get away without talking about the coast, and that is your passion. And as we talked the other day, John, you are now writing another book about what's going on with this existential crisis in Louisiana.
That's correct. And unfortunately, it'll probably be at least 2 years and probably a little longer before it comes out. I'm writing about everything, really, that's gone into making the coast a problem. Starting with, right now, I'm working on the Missouri River, which used to supply 200 million tons of sediment a year that flowed out of the mouth of the river or out the Chafalaya, and now that's down to 100 million tons a year. So that's roughly a quarter of the entire sediment load that used to come down the river, sitting behind six dams on the Missouri River. Everything, all sorts of unintended consequences, and some of them are pure carelessness. Everything works. Has worked together, the entire engineering of the inland waterway system of the United States is involved. So hope it's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm.
Another listener notes, as we have talked before on this show, you were a member of the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority, the levee board that is responsible for protecting the New Orleans area, and there was a suit filed, as we know.
That's correct. I will take some credit for being the architect of that suit. That, of course, the court ruled that the levee board did not have standing. They took it to the Supreme Court, which refused to review the ruling. So that lawsuit is dead. But as I'm sure all your listeners are aware, seven parishes have filed suit somewhat similar. They have explicit standing in the law. There has been talk of at least a partial settlement with one company. I'm not directly involved in any of that, or for that matter, indirectly involved with that particular settlement. Be a good guest for you to have on. John Carmouche or Don, his father. So there is movement. There are also a lot of landowner lawsuits, private lawsuits that have been filed. Many of them using with the same attorneys, using many of the same arguments they developed for our lawsuit. When I say our, I mean the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority's lawsuit. So there's movement, a lot of action, no resolution. Hopefully that will occur sooner rather than later, because as we all know, later is too late.
All right, another listener asks about what he calls an assault on science. This is Tom on Bluebonnet. Are we seeing that where scientific findings are now challenged as fake news like everything else?
Yes, simply. Well,
what does that do to us if we question
the science? It makes things a lot more dangerous. You know, of course, Louisiana is a red state. I'm not for Trump. I think he's our idiot in chief. However, as a statement of fact, you know, the National Security Council had probably the best unit in the world that dealt with global health. They had a section dedicated to global health issues like coronavirus or Ebola, for that matter, anything else that came up. So Trump decided that he didn't need that. So that unit completely fired, gone, eliminated from the National Security Council. The Center for Disease Control budget, cut, slashed, bye-bye. Specifically, the part of the CDC that deals with global outbreaks, slashed, not eliminated, budget cut. You know, this stuff is crazy. And I would like even your Trump supporters to tell me how that makes our country more safe.
Today, it's on page 5A of The Advocate. Rick Perry says, Trump, chosen one, sent by God. This is our former U.S. Energy Secretary, former governor of the great state of Texas.
Well, I'm glad that he knows what God wants, because that makes him the only person in the world who does. So I'm glad that God is speaking to him. And, you know, let's say Trump was chosen by God. You know, perhaps he was chosen to wreak havoc and make everybody miserable. You know, someone who claims to understand, you know, what God wants and how he is working, you know, I just don't get it. It's the dumbest comment you could possibly make. In the sense of knowing, you know, if you want to say God determined something, well, you know, that's one thing. But to know the motivation and the end result of that is something entirely different.
Well, the election is 36 weeks from today, and another listener, our fine audience, this is an observation that, of course, is true. Holly in the Garden District notes that the top two Democratic candidates right now, Sanders and Bloomberg, are both of the Jewish tradition, and you can only imagine how some rabid evangelicals like Rick Perry will be fanning the flames, according to Holly, if Donald Trump's running against either Bloomberg or Sanders.
Well, that's very possible. You know, I think I saw on the news the other day that anti-Semitic activity more than doubled in the last two or three years. I think that's, you know, a horrific fact and dangerous. You know, we are a country where diversity really is a strength. It really does help us, and we need people, leaders, who bring everyone together. You know, you cannot have, on a football team, you know, the receivers fighting with the quarterback. That doesn't work when they hate each other's guts. You know, they've got to work together. Or for that matter, even the defense having contempt for the offense or vice versa. That doesn't work. You want a leader who brings everybody together. It would be nice if we had a president who brought everyone together. This guy doesn't even make that attempt.
Well, he believes, I think as many do, and by the way, on both sides of the spectrum, that it's a lost cause, that you're either in the red camp or the blue camp. And
well, that didn't used to be the case,
no,
did it?
No, it didn't.
You know, I mean, we used to be Americans. And, you know, aren't we still all Americans first?
I would hope so, but I'm afraid that we hate each other more than we hate real enemies of our country.
Well, part of that is because the leadership has made a conscious decision to what they call them wedge issues. I can remember, you know, in my earlier life as a writer, I actually covered politics. And my first book was on politics. I knew Newt Gingrich very well. You know, he and I disagreed on everything. But I always respected him. I had, even now, probably would have a relationship with him after Katrina. I went to him for help after Dennis Hastert asked, you know, said that New Orleans should be steamrolled, and he was extremely helpful after Katrina. My point is, I can remember sitting down with him in 1984, and he was talking about developing wedge issues that would divide and split off things. That was the path to power that the Republican Party was choosing to take. I mean, that is a statement of fact. You know, you have to accept that no matter, you know, what your political beliefs. That's factual. And, you know, they've been very successful dividing. And, you know.
Well, you saw it, and a listener notes that Gingrich was a Tulanian, a couple of degrees, right. I believe, from Tulane. But that aside, Gingrich and Bob Livingston and others in the Republican hierarchy at that time, they took out Jim Wright over a book deal. Can you imagine, and here when you look at the president paying off porn stars and taking money from his foundation, and there was designated for veterans and spending it on himself, and Jim Wright was sent away over a book deal?
Which was $2,500 over a three-year period. It was a different time.
Different time, and that was your first book. You're right, and it's one service ranked it as one of the, I think, top 10 books ever written about Congress. So, John, you've been doing your thing a long time. Let's slide in Phil. Phil, we only have a few seconds, but I know you've been waiting for a while. Please, you have the floor for 15 seconds, my friend. Phil in Jefferson Terrace.
I just want to thank you, Mr. Berry. Thank you, Mr. Berry, for you give us all courage, and I know it's a tough, hard fight. Bless you, sir. Bless you.
All right. Well,
that was very kind of you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Well, John, thank you for joining us today, and we'll keep in touch. I appreciate
you. You're welcome. Take care.
See you soon. Bye-bye. And we'll be joined by Dietmar Richier, the man who is the executive director of the Amite River Basin Commission. But 75 years ago, he was fleeing Dresden with his mother as bombs were falling at the end of World War II. As many as 25,000 people or more were killed. We'll talk about it when we return after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Alondra Villarreal is producing, and in studio is Dietmar Richier. He is executive director of the Amite River Basin Commission, but one of the most fascinating people on the planet. He grew up in Caracas, but was born in Dresden, and the war was ending, World War II. 75 years ago, this month, bombs were falling in Dresden in frequent numbers, and the number of those killed is listed at 25,000, believed by many to be higher than that. And Dietmar, I think, was two, correct?
Two and a half.
Two and a half years old. Get closer.
Okay.
And got out of there somehow, some way, with the help of your brave mother. Can you give us the Cliff Notes version of this? I know it's a story you could spend the rest of the hour talking about, but how in the world were you able to avoid being killed?
Well, first of all, let me correct you. It's my mother and a higher power. I took it close?
Yes.
And a higher power, obviously. But yes, I know the story because of the account of my mother. I was too young to remember. So we were living in Dresden at that time, and we lived about a mile away from the center of the city. And everybody knew that it might be a matter of time before Dresden would be bombed. At that time, in 1945, basically the war was over, and Dresden was one of the only cities in Germany that was not bombed. It was so far away in the southeast. And so there was a lot of people that went to Dresden thinking it was a safe city. They thought everybody thought that was not going to be bombed. Having said that, the story goes that we were on the 13th of February is when the first raid went over Dresden. And my mother tells me she first noticed that something was going on because they did not know. In other words, the defenses over there, they were confused. They didn't know what was going on. So the first thing she realized what something was going on was because of the drone of the airplanes. By the time that happened, very quickly the radio announced that, that Dresden probably will be bombed. Very quickly, it was already like 10 o'clock at night. And so she went immediately downstairs, well, upstairs first to pick me up and then downstairs into the basin to pick up blankets and things of that nature that they kept in water. So that it was, at that time, that was what they had to do to wrap themselves in that. By the time all of this was going on, the first bombs started falling. As a matter of fact, one bomb fell very close to the house where we lived. And so immediately she and her sister, she was with us, were run out of the house. Mm-hmm. And the first obstacle was they had to go over a fence, a steel fence, and couldn't open the gate because there was already burning in the house and there was a buzzer to open that gate. So the first thing I had to do had to jump over the fence. They threw me like a football over the fence, and then they kept going. Things got very bad very quickly, apparently. And so she said as soon as they started walking, they looked back, and already the house next door was on fire, and bombs were falling all over the place. It got to the point they had to crawl, couldn't walk straight because imagine the flak and the explosions and everything else. And so they walked for a good distance that way. I was on her back, basically, and kept going, so to speak. Tells me that the streets, they were walking on the sidewalk, let's say, or crawling on the sidewalk out. Streets would catch fire, you know, instantly because of the heat. And the fires just all of a sudden came up.
Well, you survived, and here you are 75 years later in the studio in Baton Rouge where Dietmar has lived since the 60s. He's gone from Dresden to Caracas to Baton Rouge, and he is an engineer by training. Do you accept the 25,000 dead, or do you think there were more?
I believe it's more than 25,000 for this simple reason, personally. Because what I learned over the years, every time I talked to my mother, she was not very willing to talk, and so I took notes. She told me that at that time the city was full of refugees. Mm-hmm. You remember, if you know World War II, Soviet army was between 50 miles of Dresden at that time. The refugees from the east were coming, and there was not really housing facilities. People were in the center of the city sleeping on the streets. The official numbers, I think, they were derived basically from the population statistics of the city of Dresden at the time. And I don't know how much were they able to account for those other people that were there. Of course, those, you know, with the bombing and the incendiary bombs and everything else, no traces were left of many people. So I think it's higher than 25,000. How much? I don't know. Is it relevant, really?
Well, you know, Kurt Vonnegut, who gave us Slaughterhouse-Five, and he was a POW in Dresden at the time of the bombing, he believes there were 135,000 people who were killed. And to put that in perspective, if it were 135,000, it would be twice the number of casualties the U.S. received in Vietnam, which is a war that went on for more than a decade. Dan downtown, you're on with Dietmar. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I was wondering if you agree with Kurt Vonnegut's portrayal in Slaughterhouse-Five.
All right.
I believe that he gave a very good description from the narrative from my mother. Not only that, also my relatives, people that still know, that I knew over the years, elderly people, and so I do believe that he was probably very close to the correct number.
Have you been back?
Yes, I was in December.
December of 19.
Last year.
It's a beautiful city, isn't it?
Amazing how were they able to rebuild that city to the original Baroque style. Primarily what's called the Frauenkirche, which is the Church of the Virgin. It's the Lutheran Church. That was the biggest Lutheran church in the world. And how they were able to build that church is amazing, but they did. So
triumph of the human spirit. Several great works of art were destroyed, though, during the bombing.
Yes. There were, I'm not very familiar with that aspect, but of course there were, at that time, things were already being stored in other places, but no matter what, a lot was destroyed.
Well, Gregory Stanton, a lawyer and president of Genocide Watch, puts it this way. He says, every human being having the capacity for, has both the capacity for good and evil. The Nazi Holocaust was among the most evil genocides in history, but the Allies, firebombing of Dresden and nuclear destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were also war crimes. I don't know that I would go that far, but the war was almost over. Was this necessary?
I am not a military guy to be able to say that, Dresden was the only city left, and it was used probably by the military to some degree as for communications, transportation, and things of that nature. It is hard to believe that that was the case because, like I said, everybody knew the war was going to be over in a matter of months. Let me tell you my feeling about war, and I'm meaning total war. I have thought about this over and over and over and over again. In the context of total war, because we haven't had since World War II, we had wars, but not total wars. There's a difference. It's incredible how the degree of destruction and atrocities and everything else notches up. And it happens without people thinking about it. And so it's not trying to excuse anything. I believe it's part of that process. And so the atrocities that were committed primarily by the Germans and then all by the Allies is because it's that notching effect. It becomes all of a sudden it's okay to do that.
Well, to put it in perspective, when the Allies launched this bombing attack, the war was almost over, and Hitler was 76 days away from his death of his own making. He shot and killed himself, and some believe good riddance. But the war was almost over, and 25,000 people were killed. And one of those who almost was killed is the gentleman in studio, Dietmar Richiar. Randy and Zachary. Randy, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Yes, I just want to make a comment that the bombing of Dresden was so horrible, but it did not shorten the war one day.
That is probably correct. Yes, I would agree with that. I don't believe that it would have done any difference at that point.
It didn't shorten the war, but it was closer to the Battle of the Bulge than it was to the end of the war. And, of course, the Battle of the Bulge was an all-out battle that really was Hitler's last stand. And at that point, the outcome was still in doubt, wasn't it?
Well, no, in February it was already over.
No, I'm just saying the Battle of the Bulge was January.
Yeah.
So, but did they really know? I don't think they knew or they wouldn't have done this.
This was, the way I read is that this was for a couple of reasons to do the bombing. So, okay.
Well, Dietmar Richiar, next time we'll be talking about the Amen River Basin Commission, but thanks for your appearance today and thanks for remembering. What a brave mother you had as well. So
absolutely.
God bless her. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial. Until tomorrow, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening and stay tuned.